Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Good afternoon, everyone. You're all in the dark there, but I think it's a pretty packed house. So thank you so much for coming along. It's so great to have you here for today's mildly controversial topic of masculinity. My name's Janice Peterson, and that's right, it's Janice Peterson. I'm so sorry for anyone who misread the literature for today's event and thought Jordan Peterson was going to host. He definitely is not here, but I am. And if you're in that camp, please don't leave. Stick around. It's going to be a cracking session. So please stick around. I'm from SBS World News, and I'm sure the very, very, very smart people in the room already know that. But if you don't know that, it's 6:30 weeknights and weekends, and we also have a late news around 10:30. I would urge you all to dip in, check it out, and that's a way that you can find out what's happening in the world. It is the best news service in the world. I'd also like to begin by acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is on their ancestral lands that we gather today. I'd also like to extend my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Now, according to the responses that the Sydney Writers' Festival tweet about this event had, pretty much if you're interested at all in weighing in to the issues around masculinity, it's highly likely you'll be accused of being a misandrist, a man-hater, or a man-baby. So pick a team, let's go. As I said, we will have questions at the end, so keep in mind if you wanted to chime in. Now, the word masculinity is incredibly complex these days, isn't it? It's pretty heavy, it's loaded, because it has an incredible amount of baggage attached to it. I'm really hoping today that we can feel a little more engaged with that one word and this rather unwieldy issue, I guess, and maybe even find some better ways of approaching issues around masculinity and perhaps even ways to better nurture boys and girls to feel confident and comfortable with who they are so that they'll hopefully grow up to be the kind of people this world really needs. And hopefully on that note, I hope all of us, the adults in the room, strive to be better parents, teachers, friends that those kids deserve. Now, I'm really thrilled to be here, and it's my great delight now to introduce our incredible panel. Clementine Ford is a freelance writer. She's a broadcaster and public speaker based in Melbourne. She's the best-selling author of the feminist manifesto, Fight Like a Girl. Her most recent book, Boys Will Be Boys, is an acclaimed call to action against the culture of entitlement, privilege, and power. Please welcome Clementine Ford. So lovely to have you here, Clementine.
It's a pleasure to be here. I have to apologise. I've got a little bit of a cold. It's just come on in the last hour, so I'll be sniffing a lot.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. She really has been...
Probably caught it from a man.
Man flu, huh? The worst kind. Now, we're joined by our favourite chef too, Adam Liao. He's an author. He is the author of 6 cookbooks. He's a host of the award-winning SBS television series Destination Flavour. And on a side note, in 2016, the Japanese government actually appointed Adam as an official goodwill ambassador for Japanese cuisine. All right, now I don't know anyone else in the room that's achieved that status, so congratulations, Adam, on that note. And we're not going to touch too much on the cooking stuff, unfortunately, today, unless Bee surprises us. But Adam also weighs into a lot of topical issues of the day. He's also a man, so I think that also makes him qualified to engage in this topic of masculinity. Please welcome Adam Liao.
Hello, everyone. you hear an introduction like that and you kind of wonder, what the hell am I doing here?
What is your job, Adam?
I don't know. I truly don't know what my job is. Maybe at the end of this session we can find out.
I don't know if... Are we able to have the house lights on just for a teeny bit? Okay, thank you. The theme today, ladies and gentlemen, just so that we can see you just for a quick sec, the theme today is boys to men, the masculinity crisis. So I was really interested to start with you all. Who thinks there is a crisis when it comes to masculinity? Show of hands. Well, okay. House lights down, I've said enough. Thank you. That's really interesting to know. Clem, how about you? You raised your hands there. Why is masculinity in crisis?
I like Robert Webb's quote here from his book, How Not to Be a Boy, and he says it's not so much that masculinity is in crisis, it's that masculinity is a crisis. And I think it's not, it's that difference between toxic masculinity and masculinity and people's confusion around the phrase toxic masculinity is that a lot of people think that what it means is that all masculinity is inherently toxic and that it's hate, that phrase alone is hateful then to men and the capacity that men have to be incredibly complicated and diverse. It doesn't obviously mean that. It means a masculinity that has been morphed and manipulated in a way that gives rise to toxic behaviours. So an example of toxic masculinity is men being conditioned in a way that makes them unable to seek platonic intimacy with each other, to emote with each other, to express their feelings. We know that men find it very difficult, generally speaking, to seek help for their mental health problems, and that this in turn leads to increased levels of male suicide. That's toxic masculinity. That's not saying even that men in those situations are toxic. It's saying that they're being subjected to toxic ideas of what masculinity is, and it's having a negative impact on them. And there's other ways that masculinity can be weaponized in toxic ways against women. Entitlement, the ways in which, particularly with social media, some groups of young men bond with each other through the degradation and the exploitation of women because they don't have healthy means of bonding with each other. That's all toxic expressions of masculinity. That's what's in crisis, and that's what is critical for us to address.
Adam, how about for you, this question of whether masculinity is in crisis?
Absolutely, I'd agree with that. Masculinity is something that we have to define for ourselves. Every society does it. It's a constantly evolving idea. There's no set of masculine values that is going to be masculine values forever. If you go look at the 1990s, 1960s, 1950s, 1850s, 2000 BC, the idea of what it is to be a man has always been defined by a group. And what is a man here in Australia is very different from a man in China to Japan to the US to everywhere. Mm. And I think we're seeing that we're struggling with that definition now because I guess there's a greater plurality of voices offering an idea of what it is. Is it not eating soybeans? Is it fighting a lot? Is it being mean to one another? Or is it earning a lot of money for your family? We don't have a clear idea of what it is, and you're seeing, I guess, a lot of not well thought out expressions of what masculinity is or what masculinity should be, leading to a lot of deep problems that are being manifested not just for men, but for society generally.
Why do you think this word masculinity ignites so much passion and division, though? I mean, any sort of talk around masculinity, gender equality, is going to basically set off a bomb, a water battery bomb. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but what about falling grades of boys? What about rising rates of male suicide? What do you think of that? Why is it so divisive?
Well, it's interesting because not to at all diminish the impact of the rates of male suicide, we're often told that men complete suicide three times as much as women do. But that's not the end of the story. Women actually attempt suicide three times as much as men. They just choose less methods that are less likely to complete themselves. Which is to say that we're all experiencing, we all suffer underneath the patriarchy that we live in. I think that there's a weird contradiction, and certainly my own experience of speaking about masculinity and gender equality and trying to change the way that people conceive of the way that we behave as humans, is this contradiction that comes from men's rights activists or men who are just hostile to the discussion of masculinity, that they want to, they use the whataboutery that you mentioned, you know, well, what about male suicide, what about mental health, what about, you know, dad's rights, etc. But they don't actually acknowledge or recognise that it is feminism and it's feminists and people invested in that project who are trying to change society for the betterment of all people, and that includes men. They're trying to change the way that men are socialised and conditioned to interact with each other and to be even thought of in the world, so that they don't have high rates of suicide, so that they don't have high rates of mental health, or so that they feel more confident to be able to seek help for those things, just as an example. So it seems to me like what's actually being protested is this sense of, protested by this particular cohort of men and the women who support them, is this sense that, yes, there might be problems, but it's the better the devil you know. We understand the problems as they are. And we also understand that, yeah, we have all this shit stuff that we have to deal with, but in order to kind of keep us invested in propping up patriarchy, we all have also have these benefits too. So if we get rid of the shit stuff, maybe we lose the benefits. Mm-hmm. And I feel comfortable, not me personally, I'm pretending to be a man, I feel comfortable in a world where I can feel like I'm in charge at home, even if I don't feel like I'm in charge at work. And you are trying to take that away from me. So it's actually, it's one of the saddest things to me and one of the most frustrating things is that, and men never hear this about themselves, but women hear it all the time, men can be their own worst enemies. because they're really standing in the way of any kind of social change that will actually liberate them from the incredible suffocation that patriarchy inflicts on them. And they just don't want to see it.
I think, for you, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a hot issue because it goes to the core of what 49, 50% of our population defines themselves as. They define themselves as a man first and foremost above everything else. I'm a man before I'm a football player, before I'm a lawyer, before I'm a brickie, before anything, I'm a man. And like it or not, we all live in patriarchal societies. Almost every country in the world is like that. So it's an individually personal issue to half of the world, but it's also a structural issue that goes to the very understanding of our existence, our politics, our interpersonal relationships. It is the structure of the world is based on this idea of masculinity. And if we don't know what it is, and we don't know what it is, then we don't know what the world is.
The word, though, is not a positive one anymore, is it? Because when you hear that word masculinity, you do think crisis.
I disagree.
Toxic, because that's how it's framed a lot of the time.
I don't think that masculinity, the concept of it or the word of it, is inherently seen as bad. A lot of people would be surprised to hear this, but I certainly don't see it as bad. I'm very invested in discussions around what healthy masculinity looks like, what positive masculinity is. I have a son who I'm terrified of being, you know, conforming to what it is he's told a man is. And I know that we're at a point, thankfully now, in society where we are starting to have these conversations in a way that was never really had in recent history. So the prospect of what his teenage years and his years as a young man will look like is hopefully going to be very different to the way that it is now if we continue on that path. And to me, that's because a word like masculinity and a concept like masculinity is something that people like me inherently have faith in. I have faith in men and I have faith in masculinity as a state. What I want to challenge is the ways that masculinity and power are so often entwined and so often used to prop each other up, because I think that that's what makes it unhealthy and toxic.
I would have to say I think the main problem is we have most recently started to define masculinity not by its positive aspects, but essentially almost in relief, where we're looking at the definition of masculinity as negative space, as defined by male insecurity, essentially. Mm. You know, I'm not a scholar on this topic, I haven't studied it in depth, but if you look at something like a James Bond movie, What defines James Bond? Is it being good at fighting? Is it the fact that lots of women love him? Is it that he's physically strong? You know, I don't think it's any of those things. I think the things that you see in James Bond, if you wanted James Bond to be the strongest man in the world, why does he have a boss that doesn't understand him? Why does he have no close mates? Why does he have difficulty forming relationships with people around him? You know, these are the things that define James Bond to me. And if you ask me if Angelina Jolie is ever going to be James Bond, you'd have to say no, not because she's not tough enough, but actually because women have a different set of insecurities that a character like James Bond addresses. You know, it gives a person like me sitting in a theatre watching this tough guy doing all of these things, women never laugh at James Bond. People might be mean to him, they could literally kill him. But the worst thing that would happen to James Bond is a woman laughing at him. James Bond's boss doesn't understand him. He doesn't have close friends. If someone gets close to him, he pushes them away. But that's okay because he's so troubled. And these problems that James Bond has are what makes him a character that men can relate to. It's the kind of the reason why, and this is how I think you can see that masculinity is in crisis, by looking at comic books, because Superman was a phenomenally popular character all through the 1950s, 60s, 70s, all the way through, even through my childhood, through to now. They can't make a Superman movie that works anymore, because the worst thing that happens to Superman is a green rock. You know, Batman movies, however, are very popular because Batman's worst enemy is himself. You know, he can't have
dark
friends.
And brooding.
Yeah, he has all of these problems that men are able to identify with, and that's how I think you can see that there is a problem. You know, that's the identification of the problem, is that the insecurities of men are what is now defining masculinity rather than the positive aspects of masculinity.
Well, you both have sons. What have they taught you about masculinity, the concept, the word, the meaning?
A lot, I think. You know, being a father of sons is always an exercise in, you know, am I a good father? Is my son going to become a good person? Is he going to become a good man? What happens if he gets picked on in the classroom? Does he just punch someone in the face and show that he's a stronger man than anyone else? Or does he do something else? It's not an easy thing, but and I don't have an answer to it, but I certainly, my overarching, approach as a father is just to try to be as good a person, as good a man as I can be, and therefore parent by example rather than by do as I say, not as I do.
Mm-hmm. I feel like with my son, he... it's been such a gift. Makes me want to cry.
I always do. I'm glad you started, because I always do it too when I talk about my kids.
Honestly, makes me feel really good now. Yeah, great. I just feel like being given the opportunity to love him and nurture him has been the biggest gift of my life. I don't think it's the most important thing I'll ever do, because, you know, that's often used to kind of like trap women into motherhood. You know, it's the most important job in the world. And it is a very important job, but it's the biggest gift of my life. And one thing it's really done for me that's been incredibly powerful is teach me to have... And I'm not saying... I don't want anyone to laugh at this, or maybe you'll laugh, but it's not a joke, but it's taught me to have a different kind of empathy for men. Hmm. You know, before I had him... you know, and I wrote my book Fight Like a Girl, which is very much about women's anger and women's empowerment and the way we've been treated by the world. It wasn't that I saw men as a monolith. It's just that my heart was invested in women's stories, and it still very much is. But having him has really taught me to take a step back and think about, like, well, what's the other side of this equation? And which is why I wrote one of the reasons why I wrote Boys Will Be Boys, because I thought this is the other half of the story. You know, this is the structural oppression that I've talked about affects us all. And I see from witnessing him, and I'm sure you're the same with your son, is that I see from witnessing him that there is no such thing as inherent masculine traits. You know, all of the conditioning that has historically been placed on boys, particularly post, all babies used to wear little white dresses or muslin sacks, and then they would graduate into their children's clothes.
And wasn't pink traditionally way back when a boy's colour?
Well, when pink and blue was introduced, which is not even really that old, pink was associated with boys because it was associated with red and the Mars and the god of war, and it was thought to be a passionate colour. Mm-hmm. So pink for boys, and blue was associated with girls because it was thought to be very calming, which is why we see all of the paintings of the Virgin Mary depicted in a blue veil. But people hold on to these ideas now that somehow, like, children, who we shouldn't really gender at all, but children are born and they're inherently kind of like pop into the world with all of these values inside of them that we've placed on them ourselves. So watching my son and the way that he is given space and freedom to express himself in our home, and he is not yet at the point where he's being overly influenced by other spaces, which is something we'll have to deal with when we come to it, has been really instructive in terms not just of how I raise him, but how I can talk to other people about the way that we raise our children, you know? I was telling Adam before that his nanny messaged me yesterday and said that she's been watching a lot of David Attenborough documentaries with him. And he came to her and he said that he wanted to wear his baby on his back like the gorillas do.
Okay.
So she put this little strap carry and he was walking around all day with this little baby on his back. And, you know, it's like that there's a cartoon strip that shows like a dad with his son and the dad's carrying a baby doll. And someone's like, oh my God, what are you teaching your son? What do you want him to grow up to be? And the dad's like, I don't know, a good dad. And it's really interesting that, you know, there are so many people in the world who freak out at the idea of a little boy pushing around a stroller and a baby doll. Like somehow this is going to, this is poisoning him. This is, I mean, that's toxic masculinity, that, that somehow this is infecting him and this is going to damage him. And no one, none of those people think, you know what it's doing is it's teaching him to be empathetic. It's teaching him to be caring. It's teaching him to one day be a good, kind and loving father. And I feel like we are starting to have conversations like that now, and maybe for our boys, there's a different future.
Yeah, I'd like to think so, you know, but I get really kind of that symbolism of what's masculine and feminine, you know, is your son allowed to wear a pink dress and is your daughter allowed to kick a footy? It just does my head in. It absolutely does. You know, as a parent, you know, I have a son and a daughter and I don't ever really try to police what they're allowed to do. And I remember once I took my son in, he wanted a pink rabbit with a frilly dress from a shop specifically. You know, we weren't in a shop where there was a pink rabbit with a frilly dress. He was like, this is what I want, a pink rabbit, frilly dress. And I'm like, okay, let's go. We went down to the shop, bought it, and the lady at the shop was like, oh, is that for your sister? He's like, no, it's for me. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. And I just think it's such a weird place to fight such an important battle on whether or not boys are allowed to have frilly toys or watch Barbie, you know?
I was wondering, I mean, as much as you're influencing your kids as parents, there'll be a point where their peers are much more influential than you. Is that a fear?
Absolutely. I'm terrified. And I have a very, I'm in a more unique position maybe than others because a lot of the trolling that I get online is from teenage boys. And oftentimes they do it in packs. And, you know, I'll be added to group chat threads where it's just a bunch of teenage boys just saying, like, a mixture of absolute nonsense and then just some really toxic things about me. And I'm very scared of that. I mean, peer pressure's huge. I was not the kind of teenager that forged my own path. I very much, like, succumbed to peer pressure. I wanted people to like me. I wanted to fit in. And
but that's it. That's just the way things are for teens.
I know. And so it's, you know, it scares me to think of what, I don't know if it's scarier to think that he could go along with things or that he could be the one leading them, you know?
Maybe he's leading him to good things. You never know.
You know, and that's the thing, is that all you can hope then is that you just raise them with good values, but also with really open lines of communication so that they hopefully always feel like you can have discussions about this. And you know, ours is not going to be the kind of household that doesn't talk about this stuff a lot. And we don't inflict those very gendered stereotypes. Hopefully that'll make a difference, but it's really scary, you know, and when, you know, to particularly to see young men who engage in very violent acts against their female peers, you know, they film sexual assaults together and, or they share videos of that kind of thing with each other in their WhatsApp group. And I, you know, write about a really intense court case that happened in Belfast in my book that involved four young men and a party and a rape and a WhatsApp group. And they were all acquitted. And the woman who so bravely brought this case against them not only was completely vilified by the community, because they were all rugby players, vilified by the community. She's had to move house numerous times because her name was released to the public. Not, it wasn't officially released, but people released it, and she's been sent death threats. And there's no... What really scares me about that case in particular was that even if you don't believe that the boys were guilty of a crime, which I believe her and I accept that they are, even if you don't believe that, what happened in that room is still not good. And so that's really one of the kind of terrifying problems for me at the moment, is that there are people who are willing to defend as not criminal behaviour that they still should condemn as bad.
Yes.
But they're not condemning it as bad, which means that I think that what they're really enforcing that entitlement, that they think that young men, particularly young men with power and privilege, should be allowed to do whatever they want and not suffer the consequences for it, and that women should just continue to absorb it and not cause problems for them. It's the whole Steubenville thing, just repeated over and over, that these two young men were convicted of raping a female peer, but they've got very promising futures. Mm. And what happens to their promising futures now? No one ever thinks about what happens to the futures of the girls that are being hurt.
Yeah. Adam, did you want to...
I mean, maybe I feel like an optimist in all of this, but the world's a terrible place in many respects. It's also a great place in many respects. You know, I try not to look at it as us versus them, and at one point I'm going to untie the apron strings and my kids are going to walk out into the big bad world. You know, maybe my son's in a room like that and he's the one that says, no, this isn't the way it should be, or maybe my daughter's in that room and she's the one that stops it.
I was lucky enough to travel to Iceland last year for SBS's Dateline program, and I wanted to look at gender equality there because for about 10 years in a row now, the World Economic Forum has rated Iceland as the world's number one place in terms of gender equality. So therefore, I guess you could say it's the best place in the world to be a woman. I attended one school where they had a very different approach to education. We've talked about some of the gender stereotypes, about the blue and the pink. Well, those colours and those sorts of toys are banned. Everything's sort of neutral. I think it's best if we just take a look and then we can have a chat. So let's have a look at this clip.
How cute.
So a little... just a little snippet there of that film that I made last year for Dateline. And it's worth having a look, not just because I was part of it with my producer, Kylie Gray, but just a fascinating approach to gender, as you saw there. But I've got to say, like, I spoke to men of all different ages, demographics, very, very small boys that attended that school, teenage boys, men in their 20s, farmers from in their 20s to in their 70s. And I would ask them things like, what do you like about the women in your life? Now, what sort of response do you think I might get if I asked a group of men that? There'd be a few sort of jokes and comments, but I just didn't get any of that. These men told me, from teenage boys to men in their 70s, I like my wife, or I like my girlfriend because she's strong. I love her because she's independent, she's fierce. And I even asked a guy who was one of the strongest men in the world, and you might have, you know, a stereotypical idea of what he might say and what his attitudes were to women, and he said he loves that his girlfriend is fierce, she's independent, and she's stubborn. And it was a very different point of view, and a lot of the attitude was, in terms of gender equality, you know, do you as a man feel like you're being oppressed in some way? And the main attitude I got was, no, you don't, in terms of equality, you don't need to put someone else down to elevate the other side. We're about being fair. It's about fairness. It's not about gender. putting one gender in front of the other. So it was just a fascinating trip. But just in terms of that clip there, there was a question, do you think this sort of school could work in Australia? What do you reckon?
I think it could. There would be a lot of opposition to it because people get very funny about enforcing gender. It's the way that they take it so personally. You know, look at the response to the Safe Schools program. Mm. You know, and the inherent transphobia that people have whenever discussions about gender and exploring gender in a different way comes up.
Well, that,
you know, well, how will they know how to be men and women?
Well, like,
what,
right.
What the hell is a man? What's a woman?
And the images there of me painting the little boy's nails, which doesn't happen.
That incredibly challenging.
Well, it doesn't happen every lesson, but it can happen once every 1 or 2 weeks. But people were livid about that particular part.
So there's a school in the BBC did a documentary in an experiment in a school in the Isle of Wight, and it was with a primary school class, and they spent a term with them, and the teachers were asked to remove, similar to this, they were asked to remove any kind of gendered language from the school, from the classroom. They put posters up around the wall that said things like, girls can be strong, boys can be sensitive, all this kind of stuff, and they got rid of very gendered toys. I don't necessarily agree with getting rid of blue and pink, because I think we need to just change the way that we think about colours. They're just colours, they can be for anyone. But by the end of the term, the kids really, of course, adapted really quickly, and they ended up being the ones who were pulling their parents up on language and saying, mm-hmm. You can't call me princess. But what was really sad about it was that before the experiment started, they asked all of the class what they thought about girls and boys and stereotypes, and all but one of the girls in the class said that they thought boys were smarter than girls, which is terrifying. And by the end of it, they didn't think that. And you could present people with that. And in fact, one of their teachers who initially was like, this is all bullshit, you know, this is pointless. Mm. I don't treat my kids differently. And this isn't going to have any effect. This is just PC rubbish, blah, blah, blah. By the end, he said, I really needed this program. Mm. And I can see now the difference that it's made in my teaching and the difference that it's made in children in my class and the self-esteem that they have. And I think that this should be rolled out everywhere. And you could present people with that evidence, and you can say, when we dismantle gender in educational systems, particularly with young children, children's self-esteem increases, children's performance increases. But they will not be able to get their head around... They won't be able to absorb that information because they won't be able to get their head around, but you're making that little boy put nail polish on. That's abuse. And it's interesting because my son, as I'm sure you've got daughters, you've got boys, kids just want to do what their parents are doing. So my son quite often wants to put on makeup or wear nail polish because those are the things I do. So, and I never stop him from doing it. And I've posted a couple of photos on my Instagram account, and some people are livid about it. That boy, that woman should have that kid taken away from her.
Yeah.
She's abusing him. Mm. I've had people say of me, I mean, this is a very fringe group of unwell people. Mm. Point to photographs of my son, one in particular that I remember, he was wearing a pink jumper and a pair of leopard print leggings, and he looked fabulous, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
And say, you know, rally each other, like, she needs to be reported to docs. Mm. And I know that I've had reports made about me, so they're wasting important time because they are so bloody threatened by this idea that they think that I'm trying to force him to be a girl just because I'm trying to create... I'm saying to him, you can explore the world how you want to explore it. Mm. It's really, really sad. So I think that if someone had the political will to do a school like that, I think it would have incredibly positive effects, and that we would see that immediately in the children, but people would make it almost impossible for it to happen because they're just so scared.
Adam, what do you think?
I didn't much like the school, to be honest. Mm. I completely agree with the idea. It's an extremely noble and correct philosophy to want to remove the limitations that we place on gender, whether it be boys showing emotion or women... girls achieving and using their ability to the best advantage. But to me, that just looked like a very ham-fisted approach to do that. If all the boys and girls were painting their nails, that would be better.
I agree.
And if then the boys and girls were hammering there, to me, it's just like, why don't we switch it around and see what happens? Mm. And I don't think anything is achieved by furthering or reversing those standard gendered roles. You know, it reminded me of a podcast I listened to about a couple who was raising their daughter gender neutral, and she at age 16 was being interviewed for the podcast and said one of the things that was really that stuck in her mind that she was furious about, and she was a very well-rounded lovely girl and had obviously a lot of love for her parents, as did they for her, but she was furious when she was 12 because she really wanted this blue bike, but her parents refused to allow her to get a blue bike because blue was a boy's colour. Now, to me, that was just like, why are you, if you hate this idea, why are you persisting with it? You know, if she wants a blue bike, get her a blue bike. If she wants a black bike, get her a black bike. You know, this is, to me, I'm not sure that achieves the result that it's trying to achieve, the extremely noble and correct result that it's trying to achieve. I just don't see why you wouldn't have all the kids doing the same thing and encouraging the children to be individual rather than just be opposite.
Mm. Yeah.
How about this one then? Are men and women different?
Well... I mean, everyone's... We're all individuals. I'm not. Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. I think men and women are different, but in many different ways than we traditionally expect them to be. You know, I don't think... I mean, obviously, you can look at physical differences. We're different shapes. We do different... things at different times of different months. There are obvious physiological differences between men and women, but that then gets translated into the fact that, you know, 99% of CEOs are men. That's not a difference that needs to be, that exists. And
white men.
named Steve. But the... I think one of... kind of lost my train of thought there, but I think one of the things that... we put too much emphasis on is biology. And our entire society is a construct of avoiding biology. You know, we're not biologically programmed to talk about masculinity in theatres or do any of the things that we do. And then to retreat back to, you know, wolves are violent, therefore men must be, is ridiculous. You know, there is, we create societies against our biology. We create fair societies that are no longer the animal kingdom. And that's part of what makes us human. We were all humans before, we're men and women. And I think the emphasis that we put on, I guess, the differences between men and women, there are obvious differences between men and women. I like the fact that there are men and women. I like the fact that we have genders. I don't like the fact that we weaponize them to keep women down or to elevate men or to... say that people can't do what they want to do because of the genders that we choose to have in our society.
I guess the thing that I think might confuse people is that if we're talking about the CEO sort of thing, that we'll hear things like, you should give women a chance in those higher positions of power because they're more compassionate, they're better listeners, they're great communicators, they do the soft skills really well. And so that sort of thing sold as a positive. But then in a different sphere, you might get told, well, men and women are the same and we deserve equal opportunities.
Well, I think it's more just that, I mean, there's obvious differences between lots of different groups of people based on socialisation and conditioning. And, you know, I guess maybe... our endocrine systems are different, so we might have different hormonal influences on our bodies. But all too often, the idea that there's these, as you said, there's the idea that there are these inherent biological differences between us that are actually like personality traits.
Yes.
Is used to prop up an unequal system or is used to reinforce gendered inequality. And in that sense, I don't think that men, and I don't think that men have, men are uniquely more capable of ineffectively running a company or a country.
I mean, it's just so bizarre. We talk about women being too emotional, but I mean, who is committing all of the crimes of passion? Who's walking into schools and shooting
them up? All you need to do is look at the internet and men's response to people criticising the Marvel film. To figure out, or like men being rejected for a date. Oh, women are so emotional. Yeah. I just think that people also oftentimes don't like to think critically, and so they just spout what feels comfortable to them. But actually, more than anything, it's not the question of whether or not men and women are different. The question is, like, how malleable are humans? And we're incredibly malleable. Most of us, the vast majority of us, are followers. Mm. We want to be told what to do, what to think, and what kind of society to live in. Mm. And we often use that malleability to reinforce, again, to reinforce inequality, to reinforce structural oppression, racism, sexism, etc. Mm. But we can also see examples where that malleability has been used in really positive ways. And a really good example of that is anti-smoking campaigns. Mm. Also, anti-drink driving campaigns. There was a time in Australia where people would have been like, get fucked, I can drive myself home from the pub, don't tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. But now people would be like, drink and drive, you're a bloody idiot.
Yeah, that's right.
Or if you know, if you went into a restaurant and you lit up a cigarette, people would be fucking horrified. Because what are you doing? Mm. You can't smoke. If I lit up a cigarette here, people would be shocked. Because we had really effective public health campaigns that repeatedly told us we are not a society that smokes in restaurants and pubs, and we're not a society that drinks and drives. Mm. Why people can't see that the same approach can be taken to addressing racism or addressing sexism is because they actually don't want to address those things, because it makes them feel uncomfortable to give up the power that they might have. And that's where we need to get the message through. So it's not about, yes, there are ways in which men and women are different, and there's ways in which men and women are the same. Some ways in which men and women are the same are men would love to spend more time with their families. Men aren't inherently opposed to, we were talking backstage before about the different ways in which men feel comfortable now to express physical affection to their children. You know, there are men of a certain generation whose fathers never hugged them, and who in turn never hugged their children or expressed physical affection or did any of the domestic workload around child rearing, because that's not what men did. Men and women are different. Women, the children is the women's responsibility. But we know that that's bullshit now. And men are having hugely positive effects because of that. So it's about like readjusting the ways that we think, what is that difference and how is it holding us back?
I think the idea of, you know, ceding positions of power, and there is a difference between masculinity and male privilege, obviously, but we look at more men these days are obviously helping more with their family. That's a very good thing, but I don't think that's addressing the issue of toxic masculinity as we're talking about here, or a crisis in masculinity, because if I'm correct, I don't know if I am, but how that we're defining masculinity around, I guess, this insecurity now, you know, this idea of men need to be tough because otherwise they're weak, men need to be violent or otherwise they can have violence put upon them. I truly believe that we're defining masculinity by its insecurity or its negative space, and therefore these positive aspects are good, but what would be more interesting is, are more men being comfortable with their partner earning more money than them? You know, that would be, to me, a bigger step than a man wanting to look after his kids more. Because a man looking after his kids can still just be playing into this idea of having it all and being a superman and doing all of these things and having no weakness. But a man who is comfortable with their partner being stronger than them physically, or their partner earning more money, or having a traditional male role in that, that would be a bigger step to me than, I guess, the positive aspect of it.
We might now throw it open to questions, and I have one already from our friends in Hobart from the Terra Australis Festival. And the folks down in Hobart would like to know and let's please try and keep it brief, because I'm sure there's more questions to be fired at you. But Terra Australis Festival, they want to know, what's the one key idea about positive masculinity that you'd both like everyone to understand?
Well, just in brief, I think that positive masculinity and a liberated masculinity is one that liberates men from patriarchy and creates better relationships between them and women and greater happiness.
I would say generally the idea of strength and being a protector. I think that's it's a masculine trait. It's also a feminine trait, but I think we misunderstand the idea of strength. You know, domestic violence, which would have to be the most prevalent, I guess, manifestation of toxic masculinity, is not a function of strength. You know, no one beats their partner because they're too strong and just have to do something to get rid of all that strength. You know, the rates don't rise on the grand final because everybody won. You know, the rates of domestic violence rise because a team lost and that made someone feel weak. You know, the strength is the positive aspect. The weakness is what gives rise to the toxic aspect.
Yeah. We have a question down the front, and can I just say, if you do have a question, we have two microphones here. The lovely ladies in the yellow T-shirts, if you can line up behind them, they will not come to you. You need to come down the front to the microphone. So if you can come down to the front.
And there's a couple at the back, the exit signs at the back.
Okay, perfect. So look out for the people with the microphone and then politely take the microphone, tell us your name, and hit us with your question.
Thank you. My name's Tat. I have a question about, given that marriage equality is now legal for same-sex marriages and parenting by same-sex families is now becoming a lot more accepted, what can we learn from the families that only have one sex to guide the genders of their children in terms of the things that need to be done as a family and getting things done around the house and from an occupational perspective? How can we best learn from this community to be able to help guide a more gender-free environment?
Oh, I don't know if I know the answer to that question. I think that we can take instruction from all different kinds of family models, not just same-sex parenting, but single and sole mothers are like such an incredible force in this country, and they're also one of the most marginalised groups and completely undermined and disenfranchised at every turn. The act of parenting alone, which so overwhelmingly falls to women, whether or not it's, or to the birth parent, even in same-sex relationships, is something that needs to be addressed as well, you know, like that sort of unequal domestic division of labour. I think that we can take learning from everywhere, yeah.
I wouldn't say that same-sex couples have any better handle on it than differently sexed couples would either. You know, there are as many misogynists in homosexual male relationships as there would be in heterosexual relationships, and I don't think, I think we're all in this together. I don't think anyone's got a better idea than anyone else of how to fix it.
I think we have a question over here.
Oh, hi. My name's Kerry Bryant. Look, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I'm the only daughter with four brothers and a burly father, farmer. And, you know, they mucked out the dairy and they knew how to fix things, those boys. And they hunted rabbits and God knows what else. Now I live in Sydney and I've raised an only son and he's now 22. He's told me he's bisexual. And I don't really know what that means, but okay. But I find it hard. I thought the masculinity crisis was the men's men, like my father and my brothers, are literally dying out with the gender equality picture that we see on the screen of the painting the hand fingernails and whatever else. It's becoming confusing for men to know who they want to be, or, you know, basically it's cool to be gay or it's cool to be a bisexual.
It is cool to be gay.
Okay, but I come from that other part. I come from that other side. So, and that's fiery, and that's something I can't really put into words.
No, I totally understand what you're saying. You know, I think part of the issue is that our definition of masculinity is changing an awful lot, and it's always changing. You know, you grew up with parents that mucked out, dads and brothers that mucked out their stables. The stables still get mucked out, certainly by a lot of men, but by some women too. But that was also a byproduct of a society that was quite unfair to other people. It was a society where men were not able to show affection. It was a society where men may have known their place, but maybe it wasn't a great place for them to be in. And women might have known their place, and maybe it wasn't a great place for them to achieve in either. I don't know what the rates of suicide and et cetera have changed in it all of that time, but I don't think that we need to cling to a particular point in history and define masculinity at that. You know, I grew up on a farm. Am I a man's man? You know, I wear glasses at this festival to look quite intelligent, but I don't really wear them usually. But
what about fake?
What about the man bum?
Yeah, and I have one of these. I have long hair. You know, that's a negative strike already. But I consider myself to be quite masculine. You know, I don't think I'm all that feminine. But I think the idea that, yeah, you know, maybe if I'd run into your brothers in a pub in the 1960s or whatever, they might not have thought I was masculine. But I think I'm masculine these days. But I think our definition of masculinity has changed, and I think it's probably changing for the better because it is more inclusive. It's allowing people to do more on it, in whatever gender that they are, and not saying that if a woman wanted to be a policeman, they couldn't be a policeman. You know, that was a byproduct of a type of masculinity that it was largely exclusionary. It wasn't inclusive. And I know a lot of people struggle with that idea that men are no longer men, but they are men, they're just slightly different.
Well, and also, I appreciate that asking that question might have... I disagree with a lot of what you said, but I appreciate the bravery it took to ask that question. I think it's amazing that your son felt like he could tell you that he was bisexual, and congratulations to him. Bisexual... Well, good on him. He should live his truth. But I mean, I think that it's important to remember, like, everything Adam said is true, but it's also important to remember that our definitions, or rather, instead of the word definition, I'll use our understanding of what femininity is has changed for the better as well. The era that you're talking about, in which masculinity was this kind of like boys' own adventure where men were men and they grew body hair and they weren't bisexual. And certainly, if you know, if the suicide rate for young gay rural men is extremely high, and one of your brothers may or may not have been gay, but definitely in that society would not have felt like he could come out about it. And the era that you're talking about is also one in which femininity was expected to be not work, to quit work after they'd gotten married, to, you know, where in almost all of Australia, and well, certainly in all of Australia in the 60s, it was considered a man's right to rape his wife in marriage. That was what the definition of femininity was, that women were subservient and that they absorbed and they took it all in. And we've obviously expanded our understanding of the capacity of women and femininity extremely for the better since then. And masculinity has had to come along for the ride because men also need to be given more options. And there, as Adam said, there will still be men that want to ride horses and go and hunt rabbits and clean out stables and so on and so forth. And that's what masculinity means to them. And that's how they experience some level of fulfillment in the world. And hopefully they'll also be able to express love towards their children, and they'll be able to cry in a movie, and they'll be able to, you know, enjoy cooking or baking or whatever it might be, or come out as gay or bisexual and still want to do all of those manly men things. That's what expanding opportunities means for everybody. It's I think to want to wish us back to this sort of old idea of what, you know, traditional masculinity is extremely damaging, even for the men who embody it.
Thanks so much, Clem.
Thank you, Janice.
Our pleasure. I'm so sorry that we didn't get to everyone's questions, but I would urge you all then to jump on Twitter, social media. Put your questions out there. Do your hashtag masculinity. And I guarantee people will answer you. So get the debate happening. Keep the conversation going. I thank you all for attending. It's been a great, great pleasure being your host. Please thank Clementine Ford, who managed to not sneeze. And also to Adam Liao, who, as it turned out, was an absolute master at popular culture references, wasn't he? What a blast.
And thank you to Janice as well.
Thank you. See you. Have a great festival.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.